Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 2009 was the first year since 2002 in which the Central Ohio area suffered a net loss of jobs, 16,500 or 1.75% of the workforce. That doesn't count wage and benefit cuts. It was a bad year. 2010 will be better, a little better, according to Columbus Chamber's 2010 Blue Chip Economic Forecast. That forecast is the average of the predictions of four of the area's top economists. They've been doing this for 11 years now. Three of them are with us today to give us a preview of what they'll share with the folks at the Columbus Metropolitan Club tomorrow. Bill Lafayette, the Chamber's Vice President for Economic Analysis, is with us. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be here.
And also George Makshan, a senior economist at Huntington Bank Shares.
Good morning, Ann.
Thanks for being with us, George.
Thank you.
And finally, Jim Newton, Chief Economic Advisor of Commerce National Bank. Glad you could be here, Jim.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We were talking a little bit earlier, the job loss prediction or gain, whatever it ends up being, is an average of the four. George predicts 3,600 new jobs. Joe Mandeville of Red Capital Group, the fourth member of your team, predicts an increase of 2,800. Jim predicts 2,100 lost, and Bill, 1,100 lost. And that's a big difference to me between 3,600 gained and, say, 2,100 lost. So how do you – you're saying that a composite is better than anyone can do on their own. What do you think, Bill? Can you explain that?
Well, economic forecasts, by their very nature, are just really educated guesses, let's be honest. And so the thinking is that if four of us give our best educated guess, we average those four forecasts together, we'll wind up with a forecast that's more reliable than what any of us could have done on our own. And over the last 11 years, for the most part, we've done fairly well.
So this kind of discrepancy isn't unusual when you all get together?
No, not at all. We each probably have slightly different ideas about what's going to happen nationally, how that's going to filter down to the state of Ohio here, and then ultimately what that means to Columbus. So these kinds of differences aren't all that unusual. Nationally, locally, we always see these kinds of things.
When you average them out, don't you want to sit down and go, wait a minute, how did you come up with that number? Do you talk to each other about that?
No, I don't talk to the other two. They don't talk to me. We're each doing our independent thing, and I don't want to know what they think that way. I'm totally independent.
Okay.
I'm not going to be influenced by them, and they by me.
Okay. So what everybody wants to know, and I know it's not simple, is when will the recession end? And I guess we first have to decide, what does it mean when a recession ends? Does it mean anything much to the average person, George?
Well, the recession is defined by the National Bureau of Economic Research, and they take a look at a whole range of areas of the economy, jobs, retail sales, industrial production, and other variables. And essentially, they're looking to see a turning point, whereas the predominance of those different facets of the economy are growing rather than shrinking in size. And it probably was the case that late in 2009, the economy actually did make a turn and the recession ended. There was a period perhaps between July and September and October where there was a mix, but it became more broad-based in November and probably in December also.
So Bill, you've talked about that lag time between when you say the recession has ended and when people can actually maybe feel a little bit better about the economy. Can you explain the lag time, why that occurs?
Well, my guess is that the lag is mostly a function of the labor market, jobs, and the unemployment rate, which is just an awful indicator of the state of the economy. And people on the street still see jobs disappearing, still feel kind of nervous about their own economic well-being. It takes a while to get into trouble financially, and it takes a while to get out of trouble financially. So we have to have kind of a running start in the economy before we can really feel it down at the Main Street level. Those of us who look at the numbers are certainly feeling a lot better than we were. But if you don't look at the numbers, maybe you don't see it quite as clearly.
You're all very young men. I imagine that this is the first time in your careers that something like this has happened. There's been a downturn like this?
Oh, no, no, no. We hide our age well. And,
we are sane.
Yeah.
Well, we've seen this before. When did you see this the last time, and does it change how you calculate your projections?
Well, we've had these any number of times. You know, I can remember back to the mid-1970s when we had a severe recession.
Right.
Early 80s, we had actually officially two recessions in 90, in 2000. Here we've got another one. They each have their uniqueness to them. This one certainly is just as unique as all the others. And so we can look back to those past ones, maybe learn something from them, but we have to be a little adaptive here and realize how we come out of this and what this means to the U.S. economy, how we got into this, is going to say a lot about what the next year or two is going to look like.
Well, I remember when I came out of journalism school in the early 80s, he said, maybe you just shouldn't bother looking for a job right now and go do something different, which I did, and it was great, and it got me a few interviews because it was so odd. But now they're telling journalists there probably aren't any jobs out there for you, and they'll never come back again. And that's true of a lot of different industries. Right. It's going away and it's not coming back. You know, I grew up in the 70s and the 80s when there were layoffs and people eventually were called back, and that's very different. Does that change the calculations at all, Bill?
The economy is in a period of transformation in a bunch of different industries, manufacturing being the most significant. What's really interesting about manufacturing is that we've had a double-digit decline in manufacturing employment over the last decade. It's just been straight down since mid-2000. But the interesting thing is that while we were seeing that big decline in employment, at the same time, we were seeing a big increase in output. And so jobs have disappeared from manufacturing that aren't coming back, but the jobs that are there are very different and much more skilled now than they were before. And manufacturers are telling me even now that they're having problems filling those skilled positions, which are so different now.
If you're just joining us, my guest today, Bill Lafayette, you just heard him speak. He's from the Columbus Chamber, and also George Makshan. He's from the Huntington Bank Shares, and James Newton with the Commerce National Bank. All three of them are economists. All three of them are part of the four-person group that puts together the Columbus Chamber's 2010 Blue Chip Economic Forecast. The forecast is an average of those predictions in the areas, those four predictions, and these folks are with me today to talk about what they're going to share with the folks at the Columbus Metropolitan Club tomorrow. If you'd like to speak with any of them or me, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. George, the housing market, that's probably, for me, that's what jumps out and tells me that something very, very different than anything I've lived through. And what happened with the foreclosures and just what happened with the market in general and the access to money because of that. How that's not going to change overnight, mainly because it's harder to get money to buy a house now.
I think it's important when looking at the housing market to look at the historical context in the last few years. Actually, the crisis is rooted in a housing market boom, really, in the early part of the 2000 decade. Housing prices and housing sales were skyrocketing, but they weren't skyrocketing in Ohio per se necessarily. Mm-hmm. They were skyrocketing in the Southwest, Florida, and areas such as those primarily. Unfortunately, with every boom, there typically follows a period of bust, and that's essentially what happened in those markets. And since 2006, there really has been a precipitous decline in housing prices nationally, but it's been concentrated in those boom housing markets. I would not characterize, for example, Ohio as experiencing that. In fact, Ohio is actually held up quite well overall with regards to the housing crises. In fact, of the 20 metropolitan areas in the Case-Shiller Housing Price Index, which is probably the best housing price index, Cleveland has actually outperformed other areas of the country, including some places that we might be surprised about, boom cities in the West and in the Southeast. We've also outperformed Michigan, Detroit. So in essence, there has been relative stability in our housing markets relative to those in the nation. And I think that is an important factor when evaluating the impact of housing. It has a very strong regional component to it.
Why has the region fared so well?
Well, partly because we just didn't have the boom mentality.
Okay.
Individuals were not just buying for the sake of buying, assuming that prices were going to increase. There was a bit more market discipline in these markets. That doesn't mean it was in all markets. I'm sure that everyone can probably point to some market near them that maybe is overvalued now. But predominantly, we didn't have the big run-up in prices. Things have been relatively stable. Buyers have been relatively cautious. Sellers have been relatively conservative in what they expect. And that is helping us out right now, I think, in terms of moving out of the housing market meltdown that has occurred nationally.
What about recovering from that meltdown? Because things have changed. The lending requirements are different. Now, the first time I bought a house, it was they wanted a pint of blood. The second time I bought a house, it was, a free-for-all. It was no big deal. Things have changed a lot. Now they're going back to those more restrictive policies on the parts of banks. It's not law yet. But it has changed. How do you rebound from something like that when the money isn't flowing as easily?
Well, it's very difficult to rebound, and to the degree that we've gotten any stability or starting to get some stability, we can probably pin it on the U.S. government, some of the programs that they've engaged in. The tax credit for first-time home buyers, which is now being expanded.
Right.
We had the Federal Reserve buying up about $1.25 trillion, and they're still doing this, of mortgage-backed securities to help stabilize the market. They just, late last year, indicated they're going to give Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac basically unlimited credit line from the U.S. government. The government is trying really hard to stabilize this sector of the economy. But the thing to realize is unless and until we get those increased job levels, we're going to continue experiencing this problem. And the U.S. government can only do this for so long. I mean, that first-time home buyer's credit ends, I believe it's the end of April. And at that point in time, as these things start phasing out, mm-hmm. as we get into the second half of next year, I think we're going to see an underlying fundamental problem in the housing sector.
Okay. And another thing that you have to worry about with the housing sector is that there have been a lot of houses that have been pulled off the market because people were thinking that they would just hold out until prices improved and then they'd put the house on the market. So when you get some increase in the housing market, what you're likely to see is a bunch of new product entering the market, which would exert downward pressure again.
And so the percentage might not change very much overall because the volume increases.
The houses on the market. House prices could actually decline a bit again after that increase.
They could decline. Okay. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to take a quick break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the stories behind the headlines every day on All Things Considered. A welcome home ceremony greeted the Ohio Army National Guard's 1st Battalion, 137th Aviation Regiment. As buses carrying the soldiers pulled up at St. John Arena, relatives and friends let out their emotions.
It means everything to be home for the holidays, to be able to spend Christmas with my kids.
On your drive home, listen to award-winning coverage from the WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. 18 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1021. Cloudy skies today, some snow showers this afternoon, an accumulation of a little less than an inch, and a high of 25 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from Marburn Academy, inviting the community to a parent seminar, Getting High School to Work for ADHD Students, January 12th at 7 p.m. Information on how to register can be found at marburnacademy.org.
All Sides continues on WOSU.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher, my guest Bill Lafayette from the Columbus Chamber of Commerce, George Makshan from Huntington Bank Shares, and Jim Newton from Commerce National Bank. If you'd like to have a question or comment, we're talking about their 2010 Blue Chip Economic Forecast. I'll be sharing that with the folks at the Columbus Metropolitan Club tomorrow. We're getting a little preview today. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Harley, you are on the air.
Yes. Columbus has basically had a fairly stable economy because of strong government, finance, logistics. Where do you see jobs coming from?
Who'd like to take that on?
I'll take that on.
Okay, Bill.
Part of the reason why we've had such a stable economy over the recession, we've lost jobs at less than half the national rate. Part of that's just because we didn't inflate as much during the boom time. So the same thing that we were just talking about with the housing market, you can also talk about with the labor market. And so we didn't fall as far in the recession. And one of the big areas that really has sustained us is a sector called business and professional services. That's the area that we think is going to be the strongest in 2010. That and healthcare and private education services are the two strongest areas. Logistics is going to be much better next year, or this year, I guess, than it was last.
When you say logistics, what do you mean by that exactly?
Logistics is distribution is moving the boxes. Logistics is deciding how the boxes are going to be moved. So distribution encompasses warehousing. It encompasses truck driving and just physically moving product, and that's a major focus for our economy. Logistics is really the brains behind how that's done, because just-in-time inventory is so critically important, because it's so important to operate your distribution at as economically as you possibly can. There's a very strong science in how that's done, and we are one of the national leaders in that here in Columbus.
Okay. Harley, does that help?
Yeah. Anything on technology, technological areas, potential growth?
Oh, I think so. Part of technology is in that sector called business services, but really technology, of course, goes throughout our economy. When you look at people in specific computer jobs, we have 64% more employment in specific computer jobs here in Columbus than you would expect in an economy our size. So it's a very, very important part of our economy, and that's probably going to be one of the areas that that helps with business services in the coming year.
Thanks for your call, Harley.
Thanks.
George, you and Joe Mandeville of Red Capital Group, the fourth missing link here, you both predicted jobs gained. When we look at jobs gained, how do we compare them in value to those that have been lost since 2008?
These forecasts are primarily numbers of payroll, so it does not look at all at the wages, the salaries, the benefits, or other aspects of the quality of the type of jobs. But I do think that we have to distinguish cyclical type issues versus longer term type growth issues. And right now, I think we're experiencing, or we should experience, a positive cyclical lift across the board to employment levels. And of course, that should set the stage for improved job opportunities going forward as well. So at first they start out as temporary jobs, but later many of those maybe become permanent jobs. The firms decide to, for example, hire workers on a longer term basis because they see the economy growing. Some of those risks, in their view, are diminished, and then they increase payrolls. It's a gradual process, and we may not see a whole lot of improvement in the first half of the year, but I think we'll see a lot more cyclical lift in all sectors of the economy as we move, especially into the second half of the year.
Okay, yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay.
this is one of those places where we have our disagreement and maybe that average comes out better. I don't think we're going to get a big cyclical lift. In fact, one of the components of my forecast nationally is I think we're going to start seeing growth tapering off as we move through the year. I don't think there's any fundamental strength in the U.S. economy right now. A lot of what's happening is rebuilding of inventory and the activity associated with that. If you kind of run through sector by sector what's happening in the economy, the consumer, the biggest sector, is stabilizing maybe a bit. But unless we get those employment gains, the employment gains and the income from that are what are going to drive the consumer. It's not going to be accelerating housing prices any longer. It's not going to be big increases in stock values. It's that underlying wage and salary income, and I don't think that's going to happen. And I think businesses are going to be, throughout the year, very hesitant to hire in new people because there is so much uncertainty right now in terms of health care, in terms of cap and trade. You can go down a list of things that are going to give businesses reason to kind of pause. And it's important to keep in mind, and this should get increased attention as the year unfolds, come next January 1st, we have this major resetting of the U.S. economy in terms of its tax structure, and Congress hasn't even started looking at that yet.
Did you mention access to capital?
Well, access to capital is going to be difficult. In fact, right now, the Federal Reserve says it wants banks to be more accommodating and provide financing to individuals and businesses, and yet they're almost working against themselves in that regard. For example, one of the things they're talking about now is giving banks the ability to buy CD-like instruments from the Fed. Well, they're creating this environment where banks don't have to do their lending thing to turn profits. They can simply use the Federal Reserve and what it's offering as a way of booking basically risk-free profits.
And without injecting anything into the fundamental strength of the economy.
Exactly. So the consumer has a hard time getting financing. Businesses have a hard time. And we simply don't get that, I don't think, that cyclical boost through the year.
I tend to actually agree a little bit more with Jim than I do with George. I think that we will get a turn in the labor market this year. If you look at the Wall Street Journal consensus, they're saying that we'll create nationally something like 1.2 million jobs net over the next 12 months. But I think what's going to happen is that we're going to continue to see just slow declines over the first half, maybe two-thirds of the year, and then a small comeback in
the second part of the year. And so we all have this very small net change. And we're all thinking, I believe, to some degree, that the labor market is going to turn yet this year, which is much sooner than it turned after the last recession. But I don't think we're going to see anything as robust as what George is saying. I hope he's right. I hope Jim and I are wrong.
George?
If one looks at just the aggregate output in the economy relative to employment, that has really shot up during this recession. And that will likely to increase further here. We're starting to see GDP growth in the second half of the year, mm-hmm. Maybe even quite robust growth in the fourth quarter. I'm forecasting 4%.
It was 3.5 in October.
It was revised down because of an increase in imports,
okay.
Which is not entirely bad, and also a sharper inventory reduction, which also is not bad because that's an incentive for firms to go out and start increasing production. So the fourth quarter GDP should look pretty good. And essentially, the consumer has also started to show a bit of life as well. It's much more than the cash for clunkers phenomenon. So GDP is rising. Employment levels have been pared off very sharply across the country. In fact, if you're looking at over a 0.25% change basis, that rise in GDP relative to labor is one of the sharpest in the post-World War II period. In fact, we have to go back to the 1950s to see such a large increase of demand relative to labor. I agree with Jim that there are many factors out there that are a negative. However, the cyclical, at least in the near term, the cyclical issues will be, I think, important in terms of determining employment levels.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. We are talking with three local economists, three of four who make a prediction every year. It's been 11 years now. This year it is called the 2010 or 2010 Blue Chip Economic Forecast. They're going to be sharing their information with folks at the Columbus Metropolitan Club tomorrow. We're getting a little bit of a preview today. Let me ask you, whoever among you, Bill, George, or Jim, how much does hope play into this? How do you balance your predictions with knowing that if it's too dire, it could scare people even more? I know it's not your job, and I know there is. You look at the numbers and you crunch them, and it's pretty technical. But as an economist, how much does that unscientific factor play a role?
Oh, virtually none. Nobody takes any account of what we say.
okay.
I mean, it's not as though people are waiting for the four of us to come out with our forecast.
But they do hear kind of the headlines
out
there.
Well, they do. And I think they pay attention to things like what's happening with health care, the state of Ohio's budget problems, and what's happening with the fiscal stimulus. You know, I think people pay attention to that. But fundamentally, they are driven by their own circumstances, maybe their desire to rebuild savings so that they can have a comfortable retirement. You know, I think most people are looking to their own circumstances, not to what a bunch of economists are saying.
Well, the discrepancy between labor lost and demand gained, if there wasn't that demand or that consumer demand, if there wasn't that, how bad would we be off? How bad off would we be?
Well, obviously, the consumer in the second half of mm-hmm. 2009 was coming back to life a little bit. You know, we shouldn't overstate it here. I mean, for example, retail sales, they're saying were up compared to the year before, but the year before was the most dreadful holiday season we had seen probably in decades and decades. It's important to realize that the consumer is absolutely a major driver to the U.S. economy. It's one of the reasons why I think we're going to continue having problems. But, you know, at least through 2010, we shouldn't have that double-dip recession that some people were talking about a few months ago. Now, I happen to think that as we move into 2011, if they don't address those tax changes properly, we may see that second dip, and we may have, in fact, a W kind of event where we have a double dip. But it doesn't seem likely at this point for 2010.
Okay. Bill, did you want to say something?
Oh, just that I am a cheerful, upbeat sort all the time. But my big saying around the chamber is the numbers are what the numbers are. And thank goodness the chamber allows me, encourages me to be honest and tell the brutal, unvarnished truth. And I appreciate that.
Now, last year you were off the mark.
Badly
off the mark.
Seriously.
So the numbers weren't what the numbers were, or what'd you miss?
Well, there were
in retrospect, 2020 hindsight, of course.
Let's talk about how badly off we were. We were predicting a net decline in the Columbus metro economy, which is eight counties, of about 3,500 jobs. We saw 16,500 jobs. In the 11 years that we've been doing this, we've been right more often than we've been wrong, but we were badly wrong last year. I think, and y'all can chime in if you want to, but I think there were basically two reasons. First of all, the forecasts at the national level in late 2008, when we were developing our 2009 forecast, were seriously, gravely wrong. I think the Wall Street Journal consensus as of November was for a first quarter GDP decline of about 2.4%. We got 6.4%. They were expecting a December 2009 unemployment rate of 8.1. We got 10. So the national forecasts were more wrong than they usually are. And then the preliminary numbers that we got from the Bureau of Labor Statistics badly overstated Columbus area growth in 2008. So the trend that we were projecting from was looked much stronger than it actually was.
I think we have to go back to that time also. That we were in the midst of the worst credit crises since the Great Depression. And I think that we, as a panel, generally saw through that was a temporary phenomenon, that the credit markets would improve, and they have dramatically over the year. And that would be a factor in ultimately it not being a depression, but just a severe recession. And unfortunately, I think the reaction among most firms and most consumers, one can almost argue that they reacted as if that shock was not a temporary shock, but a permanent shock, something more akin to something that would cause a depression. And in effect, that reaction in terms of cutbacks, whether they were for labor or CapEx or whatever, that actually made the recession much graver, much deeper. In essence, part of it is maybe we missed the perception of consumers and businesses, but I think we were right in terms of the fundamentals of the economy that it would actually turn around.
Okay, we got to take a quick break. I'm sorry. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is Capital City Radio.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
And this is Capital City Radio.
The Eiffel Tower built a smaller scale. The freshest oxygen I ever inhaled.
Capital City Radio is the center of music and news. The new service from WOSU. Online at capitalcityradio.org. And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. As Democrats in Congress attempt to merge health care legislation passed in the Senate and the House, we'll hear about specific provisions of the two versions and the possible impact of the comprehensive health care reform. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820. 19 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today. Snow showers this afternoon, an accumulation of around an inch, and a high of 25. Tonight, cloudy skies, a little bit of snow, and a low of 17 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from Integrate, helping to improve business performance through brand design and marketing communications for more than 20 years. On the web at integrateinc.com or at 614-421-0004.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today, Bill Lafayette, the Chamber's Vice President for Economic Analysis, also George Makshan, a senior economist at Huntington Bank Shares, and Jim Newton, Chief Economic Advisor of Commerce National Bank. We're talking about, guess what? The economy. We had a caller earlier. They had to hang up, but they were asking about the deregulation of the banking industry from the early to mid-1990s when all that occurred and how that might have affected what's going on now or what happened last year. So, Jim?
Well, you know, I guess I may view this a little bit differently. I don't think deregulation was the problem. Graham Bliley Leach, the act was passed back in 1999, I believe it was a product of the Clinton administration. Right. It was embraced by both Republicans and Democrats. It kept officially a firewall between commercial banking activities and investment banking activities. You know, in the final analysis, I think the real lesson to walk away with from this experience is regulators. They did an absolutely dreadful job, whether you're looking at the Federal Reserve, FDIC, Comptroller of the Currency. They allowed financial institutions to get into what we now know are very risky things. I mean, consider, even at the time these things were being consummated, we had these things called liar loans. Everybody called them liar loans. Everybody knew there was not the due diligence that should have been done with these kinds of things. And yet the regulators did not question the value, the stability, the riskiness associated with those kinds of assets. In my mind, if regulators had done their jobs, we would not have seen this kind of excess. And it suggests really what we need to think about is regulators and how they do what they do. Not that we need lots more regulators. It's that we hold those that we currently have accountable for their mistakes.
Well, wouldn't a little bit more, few more regulators help the problem? Because there's been the suggestion that there just weren't enough of them out there, and they weren't as experienced as some of the people they were supposed to be regulating in the first place.
You know, I don't happen to think so. I don't think we want it more diverse. It just kind of spreads out the possibility of even bigger, stupider mistakes. I think we really need to concentrate on ensuring that these regulators in the financial sector do their jobs and do their jobs well, kind of with almost this pinpoint focus, so that, for example, the Federal Reserve, instead of having this really broad responsibility for ensuring full employment and price stability in the economy, maybe they need to just focus kind of laser-like on that price stability thing so that they don't constantly find themselves at loggerheads one versus the other.
George?
I think that it's easy now to point fingers and say it was the regulator's fault for this. But, you know, when a push comes to shove, this was a private sector failure. It was primarily in the investment banks, not in the commercial banks. Excuse me. And, you know, there was excessive risk taking. There was the subprime mortgage-backed CDOs initially started to weaken and really were a major catalyst of the overall crisis. Those were all created in the private sector, often in the investment banks, which were much less regulated than the commercial banks. But I think to lump the commercial banks and the investment banks together here is incorrect. It's really, and in fact, and historically, is what's happened is it's the investment banks that have actually have failed, primarily as a result of this. Going forward, I think one of the problems regulators had was they didn't have the proper jurisdiction over a lot of the different areas where there was excessive risk taking. And it, I think that with many of the reform proposals that are out there now, that would basically take care of that. A broader systemic type regulator would, with obviously the authority to examine and to go in and do something about these issues, I think will help to prevent them in the future.
The reforms look to streamline regulation instead of having it broken up into some of them. I mean, there's different ideas out there, but instead of having so many different agencies trying to regulate and oversee such a diverse operation as the banking system in the United States, right? Isn't that what they're talking about?
No, actually, they are talking in part about breaking it up and creating some new agencies that are going to be examining various aspects of the financial sector that are now contained within other areas that already exist. See, George and I disagree fundamentally here on the problem. He thinks it's markets, particularly the investment banks and what they did. I think it's the regulators. You know, if the regulators had done their job, there would have not been that flow of funds into those highly risky things. Markets, you know, it's kind of like water flowing downstream. You know, open up that dam a little bit, and it's just going to naturally flow down. And that's what happened in markets. Loosen it up and have excessive monetary growth, which the Fed gave us. And markets, if you allow them, are going to flood the marketplace, in this case, with these things that are highly risky. Block it at that regulatory level. Don't allow those risky kinds of activities to be on the books of commercial banks, and you won't see those excesses.
Okay. The expectation was that we were going to the market would police itself. That if a loan was excessively risky, you wouldn't make it. But the problem was that the people originating the loans were not the people holding the loans. The people originating the loans simply took their origination fees and went on to the next deal. They didn't care. They had no reason to care whether the borrower could repay the loan or not, because they had made their money.
We have a former regulator on the line right now. Rod, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Good morning. Well, I agree to a certain extent that the lack of regulation was the one of the faults in this. Basically, the regulators take their cue from people that are overseeing them, the politicians. And I can recall personally, I worked for the state of Ohio, at the time, this was in the 90s, but we weren't judged by how well we did an audit. We were judged by how many audits we turned in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, the quality of the audit didn't matter.
It's quantity.
That's
mm-hmm.
bad.
Did you ask for more help? Or was that seen as a weakness?
It didn't occur to me to ask for more help. At the time, like I said, it was looked down on. I was just trying to be a good soldier, and mm-hmm. do my job. Basically, there was a lot of criticism of auditors for not doing more audits.
Okay. Rod, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
John, you're on the air. You want to talk about the Glass-Steagall Act?
I do, but I think I'm going to switch, if I could, to talk about a little bit about the rating agencies, such as Moody's. These agencies are paid by investment banks or controlled to them to some extent. How can we expect objective ratings when they're in the, at the behest of the investment banks?
that seems to me to be a critical problem that's being ignored.
George?
Every investor has the responsibility to do due diligence in terms of doing their homework, in other words, and looking at the quality of their investments. I agree that there was a breakdown in terms of the quality of research that's going out there. You know, I would hope that there would be some kind of private sector solution to this, that private investors would seek to hire and utilize good independent analysts with track records to help evaluate. And that might be a big part of the solution to the problem here.
Okay. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And then, Kelly, you want to talk about small business loans. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about small business loans. We know that the Fed is pushing the idea that we want to create more jobs. We want the banks to start moving money, making loans available. And we know that we're going to come out of our crisis if we allow entrepreneurs to start new businesses and hire more people. But a lot of people who want to start new businesses, they've had to use their credit cards more than they normally do, so their credit ratings may have gone from sevens down to sixes or fives. But yet at the same time, because of what we've been through, the banks are more cautious about giving loans, and so they're insisting people have credit ratings maybe above seven to get a small business loan.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a balance that the banks are going to try to strike with members of their community who want to help us get out of this crisis by making it easier for people to get small business loans and maybe easing the restrictions a little bit, while at the same time not getting crazy and getting mm-hmm. giving out the kinds of loans that they know are going to fail?
Yeah, George, what is that tipping point between job growth and access to loans and that sort of thing? Thank you, Kelly.
Well, the banking industry also suffered from this economic recession, and that certainly has hurt the banks. But I do think that as economic recovery takes hold, as I'm forecasting, that the banks will start to view both firms and individuals as a little bit less risky. Obviously, improved cash flows will obviously – banks will be looking for that. And at that point, I think that credit to small business and other areas will expand.
Jim?
No, not so much. I think banks are going to be very hesitant to lend. Realize that lots of banks, both large and small, probably even more so with the small ones – very oftentimes still have a lot of these bad assets, mortgage-backed securities on their books. You know, a lot of that has not changed. Those banks are still in the same situation that they were maybe a year ago. Now, the Fed, again, has been buying up some of these things to kind of churn the market a little bit to get some of these things off the bank's books. But fundamentally, banks are still in a relatively weak position in many cases. And again, I think the government, particularly the Federal Reserve, has given them an ability to produce relatively risk-free profits. And in that kind of a situation, why take the risk on people and businesses? I don't think the environment's going to be right for quite some time.
The real problem with these mortgage-backed securities is that in some cases, financial theory isn't good enough to value them. And so if there's an asset sitting on your books, you have no idea what it's worth. And you have to maintain a certain level of reserves, you're going to err on the cautious side. And so as long as these things are out there, I think we're going to have a barrier to really growing small business lending to the extent that we'd all like to see it.
Okay. An email from Fred. If you'd like to speak with any of the three economists in the studio today, 614-292-8513, or you can email us, as Fred has, allsides@wosu.org. Fred asks, isn't the most important of the gro- part isn't most of the growth being seen now based on temporary government spending, which we talked about earlier, which is increasing our debt much more than ever since World War II? That spending will end. Then what?
Good question. Then what? I think in terms
of— How long can it go on
exactly,
is another
you know,
side of that coin.
I think we'll probably find you know, what I'm anticipating in terms of my forecast for economic growth. I think the first half of the year will be relatively good. As it turns out, George, you and I agree on something here. I have my fourth quarter number for last year exactly where he has his at 4%. I see us ratcheting down a little bit in the first quarter, 2.5%, 3%, same in the second quarter. But at that point in time, the ability of those stimulus dollars to generate additional growth is going to come to an end. And it's happening at the same time state and local governments are going to be under intense pressure, kind of like here in Ohio. The money from the fiscal stimulus to the states runs out officially at the end of this year. Now, they probably budgeted cash-wise cash management through the entire biennium here in the state of Ohio, but those funds come to a crashing halt, and we're talking billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. We had a heck of a time even coming up with an $851 million right. fix, and we're going to be talking billions.
Right, billions and billions, maybe $4, $6 billion when all is said and done, maybe more. How much does that play into your forecasting with when it comes to the state of Ohio, for central Ohio? Bill, doesn't that make a difference? And that's a lot of unknowns at this point.
Well, yeah, it's that's made this whole process much more difficult than it is most years that I've done it anyway. It's important to understand that the state of Ohio, the well-being of the state of Ohio matters here in central Ohio probably more than we think it does, both in terms of the payroll of the state itself. If the state doesn't have the wherewithal to pay government employees, then those government jobs go away.
Mm-hmm.
And because a lot of the customers of our Central Ohio companies are located in other parts of the state. And so we really need to worry about the well-being of the state as a whole. And that is just a little tiny preview of something that I'm going to be talking about a fair amount tomorrow.
Okay. Well, we've whet our appetites for that. We have run out of time today. Thank you very much, Bill Lafayette of the Columbus Chamber, George Mokshan of Huntington Bank Shares, and Jim Newton of Commerce National Bank. I appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.